Well, good evening. I am so glad to be back among the folks here at Eastside and look forward to our time in study over the next few days and hope that as we close our time together that you will be not only encouraged, but that you will be challenged and convicted in some things that we'll be talking about, we have planned, and hope that as we conclude our time on Sunday evening that you will feel as though the effort has been beneficial to you and that it has helped you in your walk with Jesus Christ. I encourage you tonight, turn to Mark chapter 14. Mark 14 is going to be the first of several passages that we're going to be looking at in our study. Mark chapter 14. And that'll kind of give you a head start on several texts that we'll be looking at tonight. It was the afternoon of May 27th, 1997, that the sky over the small central Texas town of Jarrell began to turn black and threatening. And with the tornado sirens blaring, the residents of Jarrell heard the ominous rumbling in the distance, and from previous experience, they knew that it was not an approaching freight train. The path of the F5 tornado would track across the about 3.5 mile wide span. It would track for 7.5 miles long, and in the process, it would totally obliterate the Double Creek Estate subdivision and left behind nothing but empty concrete slabs. By the next morning, the death toll stood at 27, and yet for this small town of just 1,300 at the time, there was no one's life that was unscathed by the storm's devastation. There are actually a couple of striking parallels that we can make between tornadoes and the subject of our lesson tonight, and that is temptation. One of them is that just like tornadoes, temptation occurs typically when the right conditions are present. And we find a great example of that in the Apostle Peter, who was tempted to deny Jesus and eventually succumbed to that temptation. But he was tempted and succumbed because there were already a number of decisions that he himself had already made and a number of other factors that came into play that made Peter extremely susceptible in the courtyard of Caiaphas that night. With the arrest of Jesus, he was battered by a lot of internal storms in regard to Jesus' identity. Who really was he? What was his mission? And because there were questions swirling about that when Jesus was arrested, it left Peter feeling despairing and disillusioned. You add into that the departure of the other apostles, and he now finds himself alone without the support system that he had functioned with for the previous 3 years. And then you add into that the fact that Peter is physically and emotionally exhausted. And with all of those dynamics at work, Peter simply was in no condition to enter into the territory of the enemy that night. And yet that's exactly what he does. His vulnerability was at an all-time high, and it made his sin, his failure, almost inevitable. There's a second parallel, and that is that the time to prepare is before the storm strikes. Only a fool grabs the shovel while he is in the midst of the storm and looks to dig a storm shelter. And the same thing is true in regard to temptation. And yet many of us find ourselves disregarding the warning signs, ignoring the realities of temptation until we are right in the middle of the storm. And so the key to surviving tornadoes and standing strong and being victorious over temptation is to make adequate preparations before the storm strikes. Because honestly, few of us are capable of making those vital spiritual decisions in the heat of the moment, and yet that is where many of us actually try and make things happen. The truth is that there are some critical issues that need to be settled long before temptation ever comes. Decisions and responses that need to be planned and plotted before the evil one ever comes knocking at the door of our heart. And yet, time and again, we're ignorant of the warning signs that are being displayed. We're ignorant of the dynamics that are transpiring not only around us but within us that would warn us of an approaching storm. And as a result of that, we find ourselves, instead of being victorious over temptation, we find ourselves succumbing to it. And tonight I want us just to look at four simple truths, keys, if you will, that will help us to triumph over temptation instead of succumbing to it. And I want us to start with the first one being the importance of knowing our own limitations. One of the reasons that we succeed on some occasions when it comes to temptation is that on those occasions we make temptation terribly inconvenient. And when we do that, temptation is just a lot easier to resist, isn't it? But that requires that we take an honest and an objective look at ourselves, that we genuinely try to perceive our own areas of weakness. Because when it comes to temptation, there are few things that are as deadly as overconfidence. And we see a great example of that here in the Apostle Peter. This is in the upper room with Jesus. And I want you to notice, beginning in verse 27, that Jesus says to them, his disciples, "You will all fall away from me, because it is written, I will strike down the shepherd and the sheep shall be scattered." Verse 28. "But after I have been raised, I will go ahead of you to Galilee." But Peter said to him, "Even though all may fall away, yet I will not." And Jesus said to him, "Truly I say to you, this very night, before a rooster crows, you yourself will deny me three times." But Peter kept saying insistently, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And they all were saying the same thing also. I want you to notice that Peter doesn't have an accurate evaluation of himself. In fact, Peter here believes that he knows himself better than what the Lord knows him. And you'll notice that where Satan is going to trip Peter up is not in an area where Peter perceives himself to be weak, but where he perceives himself to be strong. It goes along with what Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 12, where he says, "Let him who thinks he stand take heed, lest he fall." And so as long as a person is willing to pretend that certain things aren't problems for them, they will continually put themselves in situations where it is nearly impossible for them to stand. And we need to realize that all of us are not only guilty of sin in the past, but we stand capable of sin in the future, and perhaps even some of the most heinous of sins against God and other people. Overconfidence manifests itself in a variety of ways, but two of them are the most common. The one is naivete, and the naive person, they're simply out of touch with themselves. They're convinced that they are stronger than what they actually are. They are convinced that serious sin for them simply is inconceivable. And as a result of that, they willingly place themselves in compromising situations without ever realizing the grave danger that they're in. And so when inevitable temptation arrives, it takes them completely by surprise because they have foolishly failed to even consider falling to temptation as a possibility. They're completely caught off guard, and therefore they succumb rather easily. But there's a second very common expression of overconfidence, and I think that's what we see here in Peter. And it's either the person who loves the challenge, or, as in Peter's case, and a number of people that I've seen over the past my years of preaching, including at times myself, and that is the ones that are out to prove something, either to themselves or to somebody else. The naive person is out of touch with themselves and the reality of the situation, but the fatal flaw of the risk taker is that they overestimate their own moral resolve. They refuse to acknowledge that a person who is serious about trying to be victorious over temptation would never deliberately put themselves in dangerous situations. And I want you to turn back in the Old Testament, because there's a classic example of the risk taker in the form of the final judge, at least in the book of Judges, and that, of course, being Samson. Look at Judges chapter 16. Judges chapter 16. Samson, you remember, is the only son, the only child of some godly parents, and yet in spite of his very good upbringing, throughout the course of his life, he is going to be a man who will be regularly used by God, but for much of his life, you would question if he was genuinely a man of God. And Samson's particular weakness is fairly easy for us to pick out, isn't it? And that is that he had a weakness for foreign women. He gets tied up and involved with the daughters of the very ones that God has charged him to be ridding Israel of, the Philistines. And so the first one that we're introduced to is a woman from Timnah. She is unnamed for us. And she eventually betrays Samson by leaking the answer to a riddle that he had told to some of her friends. And those friends pressed her to get the answer from him so that they could win a wager that they had made with Samson. Samson should have learned his lesson at that moment in time, but he doesn't. Because there, some years later, he falls in love with another Philistine woman. She is named for us Delilah. And very quickly, the lords of the Philistines move in and they offer Delilah a large sum of money if she can somehow discover the secret of his great strength. And so beginning in Judges chapter 16 and verse 6, she begins this constant barrage of questioning. And she mixes in a rather healthy dose of nagging and whining while she's at it. She wants to determine the secret to his great strength. And so in verses 7 through 9, he tells her that if I'm tied up with fresh, undried cords, I've become weak like any other man. She ties him up while he sleeps, and she says, Samson, the Philistines are upon you, and he breaks them, as the writer says here, as tow in a fire. Verses 10 through 12, she presses him again, and he tells her this time, if I'm tied up and if I'm bound with new ropes that have never been used, I'll become weak like any other man. And so he sleeps, she ties him up with the new ropes, and she yells, the Philistines are upon you, Samson, and he snaps the ropes like they were thread. Verses 13 and 14, notice that he's moving closer to the truth. Delilah said to Samson, up until now you've deceived me and told me lies. Tell me, how may you be bound? And he said to her, if you weave the 7 locks of my hair with the web and fasten it with a pin, then I will become weak and be like any other man. So while he slept, Delilah took the 7 locks of his hair and wove them into the web. And she fastened it with a pin and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he awoke from his sleep and pulled out the pin of the loom and the web. Now just a couple of little insights here that I find intriguing in this particular one. You remember back in chapter 4 that Deborah had led the people out, and Barak as well, to do battle with Sisera and his forces. And one of the things, because Barak didn't believe, wasn't willing to go unless Deborah went with him, Deborah says, look, the victory is going to be given to a woman, and that woman is Jael. She's a Kenite. And so here is Sisera, he's on the run, and he comes to her tent, and she, you know, tells him to lay down, she covers him up with the rug, and then she takes the mallet and takes the tent peg, and she drives it into his temple. Now, if we were reading this in the original, we would see that the same words used in Judges chapter 4 are used here. But the imagery is of Delilah driving a tent peg, it's translated pin, but it's the same word back in chapter 4, through his temple or his head. Here it's translated hair, but it's the same word as back in chapter 4. And so what we have is this image that is being conveyed by the writer of Judges, that what had happened to Sisera, the enemy leader, is now, in a sense, happening with Samson, Israel's warrior, that there is a woman who is, in a sense, driving the tent peg into the head of Israel's warrior. Now, picking up in verse 15, because Samson hasn't told her everything, has he? And we know that, and she knows it as well. Verse 15, then she said to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? And we might add a little crying, you know, into that, might make the sound effect a little bit more accurate. How you have deceived me these three times and have not told me where your great strength is. It came about when she pressed him daily with her words and urged him that his soul was annoyed to death. So he told her all that was in his heart and said to her, "A razor has never come on my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaved, then my strength will leave me and I will become weak like and be like any other man." When Delilah saw that he had told her all that was in his heart, she sent and called the lords of the Philistines and said, "Bring your checkbook, fellas." That's, by the way, that's kind of hidden in the Hebrew there. And I am kidding about that, by the way. "Come up at once, for he has told me all that is in his heart." Then the lords of the Philistines came up to her, and see, they brought the checkbook. They brought the money in their hands. She made him sleep on her knees and called for a man and had him shave off the seven locks of his hair. Then she began to afflict him, and his strength left him. She said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." And he awoke from his sleep and said, "I will go out as at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. Then the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes, and they brought him down to Gaza and bound him with bronze chains, and he was a grinder in the prison. However, the hair of his head began to grow again after it was shaved off. Now, you read that account, and each time Delilah presses him further, and each time he supplies her with a little bit more information that clearly the enemy is going to use against him. I mean, even the dullest person in the world should have realized that this woman is in cahoots with the Philistines. And yet, it is to this very same woman that Samson bears his soul. Is he just the dumbest guy to ever live? Or is there some other reason to explain what he does here? Because I don't think it's a problem of intelligence. And I don't think that Samson is naive, that he was just sort of swallowed up by his feminine charms. But if I'm right, and he knew what she was up to, then what would motivate him to share such intimate information with her? And I think the answer is very simple. He was overconfident. He believed that even if his head was shaved, that he would still be more than a match for the Philistines. What we learn here in chapter 16 is that Delilah was not the real reason for Samson's demise, was she? Samson's own failure to possess an accurate understanding of his own limitations. That was the real problem. And so the person who is looking to triumph over temptation will refuse to overestimate their spiritual resolve while simultaneously refusing to underestimate their own capacity for sin. They'll constantly be making appraisals of their strengths and their weaknesses, and those appraisals will be honest and they will be realistic. They will strive to live within those limitations. They will steer clear of that line that they know exists out there. And in the process, just that one step alone will greatly minimize the opportunity for us to fall into temptation, right? To fall into sin because of temptation. One man put it this way. He said, "He who chooses the battlefield usually wins the war." And that's what we're talking about here, okay? That if you know yourself at all, you know there are some realms where you are particularly susceptible. And if you're aware of those realms, you can map out a strategy that enables you to avoid those realms and therefore to stand victorious. Now look over at the Gospel of Mark. Look at the Gospel of Mark. Because someone might think that your tactics that you employ to try and avoid temptation and sin might be a little bit extreme, but maybe they don't struggle in that particular area like you do, and so they can get by with less drastic steps, but they're not you. Look at what Jesus says three times, Mark chapter 9, verse 43 beginning. Mark 9, verse 43. Jesus says, "If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life crippled than having your two hands to go into hell, into the unquenchable fire." Verse 45, "If your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life lame than having your two feet to be cast into hell." Verse 47, "If your eye causes you to stumble, throw it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than having two eyes to be cast into hell." What point is Jesus making here? He's making the point that you do whatever is necessary to protect your hands, your feet, your eyes, that it's much better to take dramatic steps and go to heaven than it is to be careless in those realms and be cast into hell. Look over to Ephesians chapter 5. In Ephesians chapter 5, Paul relates a kind of similar exhortation here. In Ephesians chapter 5, let's start our reading in verse 6. Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 6, the apostle writes, "Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things," what he's talked about in the previous verses, "the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be partakers with them, for you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth, trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. For it is disgraceful even to speak of things which are done by them in secret. But all things become visible when they are exposed by the light, for everything that becomes visible is light. For this reason it says, 'Awake, sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you.' Therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time, because the days are evil. So then, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is." What Paul is telling us in this text is that as we walk in the light, we are to be very careful at the and see the entire picture before we make a decision, to exercise caution before we chart a specific course of action. To be wise, for example, in terms of our personality, to understand that there are certain temptations that will appeal to you perhaps more so than they will to me. And wise is the person who knows what those things are. To be wise in terms of our circumstances, that when you allow yourself to be in the wrong place, the wrong time, with the wrong people, then victory over temptation is almost impossible because you yourself have so stacked the deck against yourself. Be wise in regard to history. Maybe it was the home that you were raised in. Maybe it was the experiences of your parents that make you more susceptible to certain things than other people might be. Maybe it's just your own past. And you, as you look back in your past, and there's certain areas that prove to have been areas of weakness for you, take that into consideration. Wise is the person who takes those things into consideration as they move forward. If we're going to be victorious over temptation, then we will regularly and prayerfully examine ourselves to make sure to take into account our successes and our failures, our strengths and our weaknesses, so we understand what our limits are and we don't exceed them. The second point here is that we need to make ourselves accountable. Look over at the book of Galatians. We're pretty close here in Ephesians. Look over at Galatians chapter 6. While it is certainly true that sin and temptation, both of those elements flourish in the dark, they both wither and die when they're exposed to the light. And that's what we're talking about here. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1, "Brethren, if anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself so that you too will not be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ." James 5 and verse 16 tells us there to confess our sins to one another. That person may be a brother in Christ. It may be a mate. It may be a sister in the faith. But if we're going to be victorious over temptation, it's vital that we have someone with whom we can share our innermost struggles. Because in a lot of cases, not in every case, but in a lot of cases, we're no match for the enemy if we're trying to do it all on our own. And that's particularly true if it's some long-standing habit that we're involved with. Disclosure and accountability cause temptation to lose a lot of its grasp on us. It enables us to gain greater spiritual strength. And ideally, that other person that we're making ourselves accountable to is going to be someone who is faithful in the things of God. Someone who themselves are striving to submit to godly authority. Someone who is trustworthy and knowledgeable and self-controlled. But it also needs to be someone who will be honest with you. Who won't just tell you what you want to hear, but who will tell you the things that you need to hear. And when they tell you the things that you need to hear, that you understand their motive of love and concern, and therefore, no matter how difficult it might be to listen to what they are telling you, you refuse to dismiss them as simply being a jerk. I've got a lesson that I do sometimes from Proverbs. It's entitled Listening to the Jerks. Because over and over again in the book of Proverbs, what Solomon does is he tells us the benefit of listening to the counsel of other people, even counsel that we don't want to hear. And typically what happens is that we listen to the counsel that we like, the kind that we want to hear from people. And so when someone comes to us and say, you know, I've got a concern here and I need to, you know, I'm worried about you in this area. As long as it's something we want to hear, we're receptive to what they have to say. But as soon as they tell us, they point out some area of weakness or some area where we're putting ourselves in dangerous situations, we just say, yeah, they're just being a jerk. And we dismiss them. And Solomon says, look, the fool is the person who does that. And over my years of being a Christian, what I've come to realize is that most people are very sincere in their concern. And that what they are trying to share is can be a very legitimate issue if I look at myself clearly. And there have even been times when I was convinced that they weren't being loving in what they were telling me, that they were being venomous and that they were being hateful. But even then, there were some things that they said that if you listen with the right ear, can benefit you moving forward. And that's what we're talking about here. Opening up to someone in regard to the truth of your life. And that's not an easy thing typically to do, but it's one of the most important keys to unlocking the door to victory over temptation. The third one is the need for us to develop an early warning system. Back in 1984, there was an Avianca Airlines jet that plowed into the side of a mountain in Spain. And when they found the black box among the wreckage and they listened to the conversation that had transpired in the cockpit prior to impact, they made a frightening discovery. And that was that several minutes prior to the plane crash, there could be heard over the recording a computer synthesized voice telling the crew, pull up, pull up, pull up. The pilot was evidently convinced that the warning system was malfunctioning. And so he could be heard on the recording, shut up, gringo, before he switched the system off. And just a few moments after that, the plane slammed into the side of a mountain and it killed everyone on board. Now, the early warning system for our souls is our conscience. Look over at 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 1. 1 Timothy chapter 1. When our conscience is properly programmed, when it is properly used and implemented, it can save us from many a disaster, can't it? Notice what Paul says here was one of the goals of his instruction. He says, verse 5, 1 Timothy 1 and verse 5, but the goal of our instruction is, and here are three points, love from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. One of Paul's goals was his teaching to provide to his students, the disciples of Jesus, a good conscience, that internal gauge that either affirms or accuses us based on our conduct when measured against an accepted standard. Conscience is what is built into us that entreats us to do what we believe to be the right thing, thus leading to commendation and joy. And it restrains us from doing what we would believe to be a wrong thing, thus it helps to prevent feelings of guilt and regret and shame. And it's important that we understand that our conscience is not a source of information that determines right and wrong. Our conscience is not, its role is not to instruct us in morality or ethics. It does not function as a teacher. It functions as an accountant. And because of that, our conscience is not infallible. And we get a great example of that with Paul in Acts chapter 23 and verse 1, where we find Paul saying that he had lived to that point in his life with a perfectly good conscience. Paul, you mean even when you were persecuting Christians? Even then. Why? Because when he was persecuting Christians, he was fully convinced that he was doing exactly what God wanted him to do, and therefore his conscience didn't sound any warnings, but it should have, shouldn't it? Conscience plays an essential role in us being victorious over temptation, because even though we can hide a lot of things from other people, we can't hide from ourselves. But a conscience is not without its problems, is it? And one of those problems is that its effectiveness is only as good as the information that has been fed into it. And so, if the wrong information has been fed into that conscience, then it will fail to trigger an alarm or a warning when it actually should, and it will therefore leave us vulnerable to spiritual danger. The second problem that it has is that it is susceptible to repeated abuse. That if you continue to turn it off, eventually your conscience is what the Bible becomes what the Bible describes as defiled, and if you continue to turn it off often enough, it becomes what the Bible describes as a calloused conscience. It completely falls silent. And because of that, that's one of the main reasons that God instructs us, don't violate your conscience. Well, even if it's something that's not a sin, if you believe it's a sin, God says, don't turn off the system. Why? Because when you get in the habit of turning off the system, eventually the system goes to sleep, and eventually it dies if you turn it off often enough. And so when it's things like the eating of meat is talked about, you know, in Romans 14 or 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul says, look, don't violate your conscience. If you believe it's a sin for you to eat meat, then you don't eat that meat, even though that meat's sacrificed to idols that are nothing. And so if your conscience doesn't bother you, hey, you can go out there and, you know, you can eat that meat that's been sacrificed to an idol. But don't violate your conscience, because violating conscience means you've got to turn it off in order to eat the meat. Look at skip down to the same chapter here. 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 18. We find a couple of men who apparently did that. He says, this command I entrust to you, Timothy, my son, in accordance with the prophecies previously made concerning you, that by them you fight the good fight, keeping the faith and a good conscience, which some have rejected and suffered shipwreck in regard to their faith. And then he names them in verse 20, Hymenaeus and Alexander. There was a little boy who asked his mom one time what his conscience was. And after thinking for a few moments, she said, your conscience is that little voice that warns you when you're about to do something bad. And so that night, the little boy prayed, dear Lord, please help my little voice to be very loud. And that's what we're supposed to be doing, isn't it? That when the warning lights go off, that when the flags go up, if we're planning on being victorious over temptation, that's not a time for us to ignore the warnings. It's not a time for us to turn off the system. It's time for us to take drastic action. And then the fourth point is that we need to hide the word in our heart. Look over James chapter 1. James chapter 1. Since the early warning system is only of value if it's been properly trained and the right information has been put into it, we increase its effectiveness by exposing ourselves to the right truths. And in James chapter 1, beginning in verse 13, James speaks to the subject of temptation. And you'll notice in verse 13, he says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil. And he himself does not tempt anyone, but each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Notice that temptation is not a matter of when, not a matter of if, it's simply a matter of when. It's just like trials that he talks about back in verse 2, where he says, consider all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Not if you encounter them, just when you encounter them. The same thing's true with temptation. It's not a matter of if you encounter temptation, it's when you encounter temptation. And literally, verse 13 reads, when he is being tempted. That is, in the heat of that moment, let nobody think that they can take themselves off of the hook by saying God's the one who's doing this. And he gives two reasons for that. The first one is the nature of God himself. He says in verse 13, look, God cannot be tempted by evil. God has no capacity for wrongdoing. He has no vulnerability to sin. The second issue that he points to has to do with the nature of man. That little phrase, carried away, was used as a hunting term in the Greek, and it spoke of luring an animal into a trap by the use of bait. The word enticed in that verse is a fishing term that spoke of baiting a hook in order to draw fish. And what I find intriguing about both of those terms is that neither one of them speaks of force. They speak of persuasion. When it comes to temptation, James says, look, the problem isn't God, and the problem really isn't even Satan. That when it comes to temptation, we've met the enemy, and the enemy is us. That Satan may set the trap, that Satan may bait the hook, but Satan has no ability to make us take the bait. If a fisherman could do that, it would no longer be fishing. It would actually be fun. It would be catching. Right? If the fisherman could make the fish take the bait. But the fisherman doesn't have that ability. Now, the fisherman can make it as alluring as possible. You know, he can, you know, move the bait and use certain baits for certain kinds of fish. You know, the fisherman can be very smart. But he can't make the fish take the bait. And Satan can't make us take the bait either. He baits the hook. He sets the trap. But the draw, James says, comes totally from within us. And therefore, the importance of the previous three points, knowing our limitations, making ourselves accountable, developing that strong conscience, that strong warning system. Now, James goes on in verse 15 to talk about lust. He says, well, in verse 15, enticed by his own lust, and when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. And the word here is actually a neutral word in the Greek, and the word itself is not good or bad. You determine whether it's being used in a good or bad way by the context of the passage. Now, clearly, the context here would tell us that this is being used in a bad way. It's pointing out a bad thing. And lust consists of a couple of elements to it. The first one is desire. Lust is a desire, but it's typically a desire in this context, especially for something that we shouldn't have. We shouldn't be wanting. It's a desire for something that has been off limits, made off limits by God. But there's has to be a second component to lust. It's not just a desire, but there must also be an accompanying deception too. And that is that we must begin to rationalize and justify our taking of that thing that we want. And so we might begin to ask ourselves the question, you know, does the Bible really teach that that's sinful? Or we ask ourselves the question, you know, doesn't God want me to be happy? Or, you know, don't I deserve this? Or we pass it off and we say, you know, I'm just an imperfect human. I'm going to be prone to sin. James reveals here that it's the person who can control his or her desires and who refuses to be deceived by the bait that Satan puts on the hook. That's the person that's going to be victorious over temptation. And it's this last element that's our focus in this final point. Because since temptation takes advantage of the doorway of our mind, nothing is more crucial to triumphing over temptation than what we choose to put into it. And so if we spend the bulk of our week taking in all of this information from the world, understand that we're feeding our minds an unhealthy diet that will dramatically reduce our ability to resist temptation. But the more we fill our minds with the will and the wisdom of God, the more we inundate ourselves with divine revelation, the increasingly resilient we will become when it comes to standing against temptation. Look back at Psalm chapter 119. Psalm 119, the psalmist here gives us a marvelous piece of instruction in this area. Psalm 119, beginning in verse 9. Psalm 119 and verse 9. The writer says, how can a young man keep his way pure? By keeping it according to your word. With all my heart I have sought you. Do not let me wander from your commandments. Your word I have treasured in my heart that I may not sin against you. If you want to see how effective hiding the word in your heart can be, read the first 11 verses of Matthew chapter 4 and look at the example of Jesus in the wilderness. He is there, he is tempted three times by Satan himself, and three times he resists. And what was his secret weapon? He quotes three passages from the book of Deuteronomy. Now, let me ask you tonight, if you had to quote three passages from the book of Deuteronomy and your soul depended on it, could you do it? Because that's what Jesus does. Now, understand, Jesus is not just quoting words. Those words meant something to him. And we see that in what the psalmist says here. Verse 10, "With all my heart I have sought you. Do not let me wander from your command." We're not talking about just, you know, well, I've got the words in there. There is also a heart that is desirous of applying those words. Can you imagine committing a sin as you are thinking in your mind several passages and you're quoting them to yourself that declare that activity to be a sin? Now, there might be somebody that's brazen enough that they could do that. I think that's the minority. And I think it's a very small minority. What we find Jesus doing is taking the Word of God and hiding it in his heart, and it caused him to stand toe-to-toe with Satan himself and to walk out of the wilderness the victor. The Word of God is bread that is to be eaten. It's not just literature to be admired. And when it comes to its message, we can't approach it simply to accumulate information. Rather, we approach it for the purpose of it revealing to us who we really are, and therefore giving its submitting to its ability to change us. And go back to the book of James, one last passage, James chapter 1. And I want you to notice this analogy that James uses in this text. James chapter 1, and let's begin our reading in verse 23. James chapter 1, beginning in verse 23. James says, "For if anyone," this is James 1 and verse 23, "if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. For once he has looked at himself and gone away, he has immediately forgotten what kind of person he was. But one who looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides by it, not having become a forgetful hearer, but an effectual doer, this man will be blessed in what he does." Notice the image that James paints here of what the Bible is. He describes it as a mirror. And I understand that there are times that we look at a mirror. My wife periodically looks at the mirror. But when she's looking at the mirror, she's simply noticing how dirty the mirror is, and therefore to get some Windex and to clean it up. We don't look at mirrors. We look into mirrors, don't we? We look into the mirror to see what it is revealing about ourselves. And every morning we wake up and we see that scary sight when we look in the mirror for the first time in the morning. And then we set about doing something that scared us. You know, we shave, we comb our hair, we fix ourselves up because of what the mirror is revealing to us. And maybe it's happened to you. It certainly has happened to me. Not a huge amount, but there'll be times where in the morning, I'm just totally distracted. And at lunch, I go in, you know, and I'm in the bathroom and I look in the mirror and I go, I never shaved this morning. I saw it. I knew I needed to do it. I do it every morning, but I didn't shave. I saw it, but I didn't do something about it when I saw it. And James is making the point that when we look into the mirror of God's Word and it reveals something about us that needs to change, something that needs to be fixed, James says the time to commit yourself to doing that is while you're standing in front of the mirror. Because if you walk away from the mirror, chances are good you're going to forget about it. And so James says, look, you make the commitment. You may not make all of the changes of what you see, but you make the commitment to make that change and you keep it in the forefront of your mind. There are some striking parallels between tornadoes and temptation. One of them, they occur when the conditions are right. Number two, the time to prepare is before they strike. And here's the third one. Destruction results if you ignore the first two. Destruction results if you ignore the first two. Now, the four points that we've looked at tonight, I assure you, this is not some magical formula. You know, I haven't fed you some magic pill, some mystical pill that, you know, is going to just render you immune to temptation from this point forward. But what I can say with confidence is that when you and I faithfully implement those four very simple and basic truths, we increase our chances of standing against temptation dramatically. But if we ignore them, If we neglect them, then understand that sin is going to eat our lunch. And it could well come at the cost of our soul. And so the choice is ours as to what will we do with what we've learned. Will we understand our limitations? Will we look to make ourselves accountable? Will we work at training that warning system that God has built into each and every one of us? And will we hide His Word in our hearts? So that when temptation comes, we can be like Jesus was in the wilderness. And we can stand strong. And we can be the victor. Tonight, do you need to become a child of God? If you're not a Christian tonight, I can assure you that you are being tempted right now to do nothing about it. And the reason I know that is because I've been there. I was baptized. I was 20, 21 years old. I was a slow learner. And I resisted for a long, long time. And I could come up with all kinds of excuses. Ultimately, I was simply listening to the wrong voices. Listen to the voice of the Lord tonight. What He is offering to us in the blood of Jesus Christ, the relationship with Him, our Creator, that has hope on the other side of the grave. You want that tonight. You need to render your obedience to the gospel of Jesus this evening. Don't listen to the voice of Satan. Don't take the bait that you've got plenty of time. Tonight's the night. Come right now while together we stand and sing.